Silencing your reptile brain and living in the moment, the Football Super League and its super critics, and how to ensure you get your solid 7 hours every night. All that and more coming up on today's Playback Daily for Tuesday, the 20th of April. I'm Gemma Craddock, and let's have a look ahead.
It's denying the opportunity for any other clubs to join this self-appointed aristocracy, who are really just sitting there at the moment wondering, you know, trying to keep a poker face and wondering if they can get away with what they're trying to do here.
Sleep hygiene basically says that we should use our bedrooms for sleep and, if we're lucky, for sex.
And I think on that first day, I must have listened to an introductory meditation about 60 times. Because every time I did the meditation, Ray, there was a tiny brief second where I felt, oh, maybe it's not all that bad.
On Today with Claire Byrne, Dr. Shane Bergen, a physicist at UCD's School of Education, dropped by to answer some of the big questions. And Claire started with a doozy.
What is life, and do we know how it started where we are on Earth?
Imagine after like hundreds, if not thousands of years of doing science, we still don't know what life is.
What are you guys up to?
This would be a good chance for us to ask for more money, perhaps. Yeah. Senya. But we have learned an awful lot, in fairness. So we now know the age of the Earth. We now know that DNA is essential to our being. We know that we evolved. So we're piecing together a lot of information that's getting us closer to understanding what is life and how life may have started on Earth. And part of that journey is us looking for life elsewhere. Are we unique? Is there something special about this little blue gem in the heavens that has allowed for life to take here but not anywhere else? I would say that science is moving in the direction that we think it is far more likely that life exists in other places or has existed in other places than us being an outlier.
Well, let's look at one of our nearest neighbours then, Mars.
Yeah.
Might there be life on Mars?
Life on Mars. Well, at the moment, probably not. But there may have been life on Mars. So the Earth, as I said, is quite old. It's 4.5 billion years old. And the early Earth and the early Mars looked very similar. Both had liquid water on them. Both had a healthy atmosphere. And life took on Earth very early on. So it's quite reasonable to think, given how similar Mars was to Earth back then, that life may have taken there too. And at the moment, we're in the middle of perhaps one of the most exciting space missions to Mars that we've ever had. Perseverance, the NASA rover, is on Mars at the moment. And just yesterday, they launched the very first helicopter on Mars. It's kind of like a drone. And they operated that from Earth. And they operated it in a situation where they have very little atmosphere over there. So this thing was able to lift off for 39 seconds and land again. And they're hailing it as significant as the Wright brothers' journey back in the early 20th century.
And clearly during the 39 seconds, it was recording, was it?
It was, yeah. And so this journey to Mars, Perseverance, is there to look for fossilized evidence of life. So did life exist in the past? And can we find examples of it in the rock now? So it has a drill and it's going to dig down into the surface of Mars, dig up samples, collect them, and then we're going to send over another rover in a couple of years to collect it and bring it back, and we'll have a look and see what's in it.
Exciting. And what do you think, or does science tell you, life there would look like?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it'll be very primitive. We're talking single cell stuff here, right? There's not going to be plants or animals, most likely. Most certainly there isn't any evidence of a civilization over there. So we're looking at, you know, very, very primitive life. But if we can show that, then we can show that life perhaps is far more universal than we think. And so when we look out further into space, it wouldn't be unreasonable for us to think of there being life elsewhere. And so we look in other places around the universe for similar situations to Earth or to Mars.
So beyond Earth and Mars, are they the only candidates for life in our solar system, or have we just not begun to investigate that?
Well, I guess we always think of our solar system as the planets. But of course, many of those planets have moons. And two moons in particular are good candidates for life. One is called Europa. It's a shiny moon around Jupiter. Another is called Enceladus. And it's around Saturn. And both have liquid water. under a frozen surface. So they have the basic ingredients for life. So they have water in a liquid form. So there have been two missions to those far off moons, and they've literally sniffed the atmospheres of these moons to see, are there any signs of life there, current or past?
And what do they find?
Well, we find that there's the basics there, but of course, like something for a bar to say there is life elsewhere, that's a really high bar. So you need an awful lot of evidence. So we haven't found anything that we could definitively say there is life yet, but we're finding the ingredients.
Let's look beyond the solar system then. Can we? Is it possible?
It is, yeah. Isn't that incredible? So as well as there being planets in our own solar system, there are thousands, if not billions, of planets around other solar systems. So we have our sun, that's our star, and there are lots of other stars in the Milky Way. And most of those, it seems, have planets around them. And we can use things like the Hubble telescope to look at them. And what we're looking at here is incredibly small. We're looking at a tiny, tiny little world. So when you think of a star, it gives out light, so we can see that light. But a planet doesn't give off light, so how do we see it? What we have to do is wait for it to pass in front of its star. It transits, and you get a silhouette. And when you see that silhouette, it is literally like a needle in a haystack. You can identify the planet. And we've now gotten to the point that we can not only see the planet, but we can see the very fuzzy atmospheres around these far-off planets. And soon enough, we'll be able to tell what chemicals are in those atmospheres. And if we're able to find planets that have oxygen in their atmospheres, the chances of them having life on it would increase dramatically. So we look for things that are in the so-called Goldilocks zone. So they're close enough to their star such that they have liquid water, but not so far away that it is frozen, or not so near that it is vapour. So it is in that magic zone.
It is mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling to even contemplate it. And there's this new telescope that you're going to tell us about, which looks for oxygen in these places.
Yes, and we've been excited about this one for a long time, but it has been slow in coming. It's the successor to Hubble. It's called the James Webb Telescope. And it will look at these far-off planets as well as things closer. And one of the key things it's going to look for are those sort of traces of oxygen. But there's another one, and there's an Irish one. So there is a kind of a group of scientists that are looking for radio signals from intelligent life far away. So we know that the radio signals that we produce here on Earth, such as this one, mm-hmm. is able to transmit out into space. And so it's conceivable that people in a long, long time will be listening to this show in a far off world. So you have a great responsibility as a broadcaster, Claire.
Absolutely, because when you put it that way.
So we're the first sign.
So you're saying then that what we're listening for are alien radio stations to see, are they listening to, I don't know, Sonny and Cher? Like, what are they into in these places?
Or what are they hearing that we're putting out?
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. From what time? From what era?
Well, you see, light travels at a fast rate, but it's fixed. So it's going to take a long time for a radio signal to travel from a far off world to Earth. So anything we hear is going to be thousands of years old.
But we are listening.
We are. And we have lots of things pointing toward the sky. Most of them are radio telescopes. And there's one in Ireland called ILOFAR. It's in the grounds of Birr Castle. And it's part of a Europe-sized array. I say that it's Europe-sized because there are lots of nodes dotted around the continent of Europe. And they add up together to form one giant radio telescope. Okay. Isn't that incredible?
It is incredible. And so down to brass tacks then. What are the hopes, or how certain are you, can you be, that these faraway worlds might harbour civilised life? You seemed more hopeful when you were talking about what might exist beyond our own solar system.
Yes, indeed. So we're looking for similar Earths out there. In the 1960s, a physicist called Drake came up with an equation where he was able to work out the probability of there being life, civilized life out there that would exist at the same time as us, that we could potentially notice them and they could notice us. And in it, he has lots of different factors and he has to weigh up the probability of each. And when this came out first, we didn't know about all these planets beyond our solar system. So the number of potentially civilized people out there beyond the Earth was thought to be very, very small, if not zero. now we know an awful lot more. We can fill in an awful lot of the gaps in this equation. And so the potential number of civilizations out there is increasing. It's only going up. And the thing that perhaps is bringing it down, this is a little concerning, is how long does an average civilization last? So if you think you'd have to have planets, you'd have to have water, they have to have life on them, they have to have radio communications, etc. And then go, but how long will they last? Because it's conceivable that they won't last forever. And that number, unfortunately, is always being reduced down because we are showing capacity to kind of do away with ourselves.
We always hear about conspiracy theories when we discuss this topic. And John Radcliffe was the intelligence director for Donald Trump, for that regime. And he recently claimed there have been many more close encounters of the third kind than the authorities have been willing to share.
Yeah, he did. And those that might know about him would know he said a lot of other things that are sort of similar in their thrust. And the first thing I'd always think is like, well, why would he say that? Right. It sounds as if the next line is there's stuff out there that we're not telling you about. And I would say that kind of does fall into the conspiratorial end of things. So if people are interested, we're doing a lecture today in UCD at 4 o'clock on conspiracy theories. They can follow me on Twitter and I'll tell them how they can sign up. They're going to hear from Kasim Kassam, a world expert in conspiracy theories.
Great. What's your Twitter handle, Shane?
It's Shane Bergen.
Great. Simple enough.
Well, you may not be able to attend that lecture live, but there will be a video made available online. Dr. Shane Bergen on Today with Claire Byrne. What better time than during a global pandemic with almost every form of distraction unavailable than to start meditating? Right? Anyway, if you've been unsuccessful thus far, Connor Creighton's sound and soothing advice on Ray Darcy will have you converted. After a couple of ill-spent decades, Connor explained how his journey into meditation started.
I heard about meditation on so many occasions, but I've just always been very cynical and always quite close-minded. And it took a breakup, a very dramatic breakup. I'd been engaged to someone and I thought that this person was finally my cure for depression. This was my road to happiness, you know, blue skies ahead. And then that relationship broke up and I remember just lying on my carpet. I was age 33 and I'd had a panic attack and just had this moment where I was like, I'm 33 years of age. Like, what is going on here? How come I haven't got this together? And fortuitously or magically, or maybe just this is the genius of commerce and marketing, I remembered that I'd got an advert on Facebook that day from Headspace and downloaded the app. And then I think on that first day, I must have listened to an introductory meditation about 60 times. Because every time I did the meditation, Ray, there was a tiny brief second where I felt, oh, maybe it's not all that bad. And that was kind of enough. That was enough for me to sort of be very curious. Mm. And then
how
the other
did you
thing
describe, how do you describe meditation to me? I'll just read a paragraph in the book there. Just meditation is very simple, but it's also really hard. You've got to go into it with no expectation, even though you're obviously trying it for a reason. You've got to make some effort, but not too much. You've got to let go without dropping completely off to sleep. You need to be determined, but not grasp. You need to want it, but you also need to not want anything at all. Meditation is very simple, but it's also really hard. And after an entire lifetime, you'll still feel like a beginner. What your any makers.
Sounds like Bob Dylan song lyrics now.
Yeah. So what's your pitch, you know, when you meet somebody, probably not in a bar anymore, but you meet somebody and they go, what is this meditation, Connor? What is it?
Well, this is the thing. I feel that meditation is kind of like a radical encounter with yourself. And I think that for the most part, we spend our lives on autopilot. We go around doing things, not really from a sense of intuition, but from a sense of habit. You know, I wear these clothes because I've always worn these clothes. I do this job because this is the job that I kind of came to me. I eat these foods. And meditation is sort of a technique for learning how to just become aware of what you're doing. Like, and I think the clearest example is this, and it's one that we all have, is like, do you ever find yourself in the fridge with the door wide open and you don't know what you're doing there? And I think most people can relate to that experience. And then if you even kind of bring that experience into every other aspect of your life, it's you'll see that there's so many of the decisions that we've made, we haven't really been involved in that decision making. It just somehow happened. So meditation is a way of kind of bringing a new awareness to everything that you're doing. And by doing this, you kind of realize, hold on, maybe I'm not actually doing what I want to do. Maybe I'm creating my own misery. And this is sort of, this is the opportunity that meditation affords.
In the book, you say that meditation is an alternative to thinking.
Yes.
Go on, explain yourself.
So one of the most interesting things when we begin to look at our minds, right, is that you begin to see that you are not creating your own thoughts. Like, you have no idea, Ray, of the next thing that you're going to think, in the same way that you have no idea of the next thing that I'm going to say. Like, we can close our eyes and we somehow, and this is the thing, we often, when it comes to thoughts, we imagine that we're the one in the driver's seat. But the reality is, and the reality becomes apparent when you observe your thoughts and study your thoughts in the kind of laboratory that is meditation. And that's when you see, hold on, I'm actually just the passenger here. And when we begin to kind of look at thoughts at another level, we recognize that the vast majority of our thoughts make us miserable. They make us stressed out. They make us worried. And this is just the nature of our brain. Our brain has been designed not to make us happy, but to keep us alive. And so once you can begin to see this, and when you can begin to learn to have a relationship with your thoughts where you're like, well, maybe that's not true. Or maybe I don't have to believe that. Or maybe I don't have to react to that impulsively. This gives you a kind of a beautiful freedom.
So thoughts aren't facts. What are the differences between emotions and thoughts?
Well, everything begins with a thought, and then the thought kind of will trigger an emotion too. And the thing about emotions quite often is that there's so many layers connected to them. And but kind of from the point of view of meditation, is you'd really kind of, emotions can be handled in the exact same way as thoughts.
Okay.
Emotions are just naturally occurring things inside the body, in the same way that thoughts are naturally occurring things inside the head. The problem that we have with emotions is that they're often very confusing. You know, we feel anger when actually we're just really sad. So what meditation is, in a way, is it's sort of also just a way of kind of sitting with big emotions rather than running away from them all the time.
Yeah, like there's words in the book repeated again and again, like patience and silence and doing nothing.
Yeah.
And these are all passive enough words. But for all the passivity in the vocabulary, it's very radical, because what you are asking me to do, if I follow your lead, is to...
Yeah, if you join the cult, right?
is to leave behind everything I've sort of thought to be true for my whole life. You know.
Yeah, but Ray, what if most of the things you thought to be true were negative things about yourself?
Well, that's the thing. My wife read your book before I did, right? And she said,
"Yeah,
this is going to change your life, because he's from Kildare. He speaks your language." She says, "This is going to change your life. If any book can make you meditate, this is the one. This is the one. This is it."
Was she right, Ray?
What? Well, I was explaining to our listeners before you came on that I sort of crammed it, which is probably not the way to read it, so I will go back to it at a future date, hopefully in a couple of weeks, and read it at my leisure and do the exercises, because as you go through each chapter, you give a context and then you give an exercise, which is which is great.
Yeah. Just at a practical level, though, you know, like the vast majority of us, we wake up and our thoughts, like the first thoughts that hit us are kind of tormenting thoughts. Now, we may not entirely realize this, but if you begin to look at, say, like the majority of our thoughts are worry or stressful planning.
Yeah.
And if you can begin to have a kind of a relationship with your thoughts, where you look on the thoughts in the same way that you might look on the wallpaper in a hotel room, as sort of, I don't particularly like them, but I don't have to worry about it so much. It can completely change your idea. Like, imagine waking up on a Monday morning with a Sunday morning feeling. And this is all just about your relationship with your thoughts.
Yeah. Because, you know, it obviously leans a lot on Buddhism, and the Buddhist belief is that life is suffering. And does meditation help us to deal with that suffering?
Yeah, what I think is sort of more applicable to a Western audience, I think, is to say that life is unsatisfactory.
Right.
You know, like when you say life is suffering, someone's like, oh, Jesus wept. Says, I don't want anything to do with this.
Yeah.
But if you say that life is unsatisfactory, I think we can all relate to that. You know, you fall in love and then after a while you start to become narky with each other. You go on holiday and then after a while you're like, oh, the sun's a bit too hot. You know, where you kind of, you buy a car and you're very excited about the car, but after a while you're like, oh, Jesus, this thing is costing me so much. So it's sort of how... The nature of life, because everything is in constant change, means that things are constantly slightly unsatisfactory. And now what the teaching of Buddhism is that if you can then find your sense of happiness and your sense of joy and your sense of peace from within you by doing absolutely nothing, then you don't require things outside you. Now, this doesn't mean that you turn into a plant.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It doesn't mean that you go and you find a cave in the Kura Ray and, you know, we never hear or see from you again. But if you're aware of this and you have this in your head, it kind of just makes the suffering a little bit less. Your car breaks down and you're like, well, it was going to happen.
Mm.
You know, you get a little bit older and you look at your face and you're not distressed. You're like, well, this is natural. So it helps you deal with the highs and the lows.
The irony of it all is, of course, Connor, is that doing nothing takes an awful lot of effort.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's that's why people give up on meditation, don't they? Because it is an awful lot of effort. Like you tried it and then had to go back. You know, you went away from it and came back to it, didn't you?
Yeah, and this is also this is what I tell everyone who ever comes to me is, like, it's you do go away from it and come back to it, and then eventually you hit a point where you're like, with all habits, where you realize, hold on, this is really good for me, and I don't ever want to let it drop again. But I think at the beginning, a lot of people, their problems with meditation are they feel that it's something you're supposed to be good at, and I actually think, the harder the time you have meditating, the better the meditation student you'll become.
Mm.
If it comes really difficult to you and you just stick with it, that builds up the kind of resilience that's required to kind of keep going with it.
There's a quote from one of your grandparents. I don't know which one it is because I think they're all mentioned in it. Is it something to the effect that some things are better off felt and not telt? You do your best.
My grandparents from Belfast.
You're over 300 pages to describe what meditation is, but some people might go away from the book still not knowing. And until such time as you do it and do it successfully, in inverted commas, you won't understand what it is.
Yeah, and I think I made the analogy. I drew the comparison. Like we got sex education in school of Vera Klein from a nun, Sister Dominica. And I just remember thinking, like, we're getting sex. Here we are in a room where nobody's had sex and we're all talking about sex. And it's sort of similar with meditation. There's a book that's all about meditation, but really the felt experience is what kind of confirms it. You know, talking about meditation, it's a little bit like, you know, dancing about architecture or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Should everybody meditate? You believe so, yeah?
Yeah.
And can everybody totally. Can everybody meditate?
If there's breath in your body, you can meditate.
Are some people better at it than others?
It's not about that. I think there's some people who have more suffering and more kind of... I mean, for me, like I look on my early childhood as like good fortune in a way. I tried to find success, or even so much in my life, like I tried to find success as a writer and contentment as a writer. I didn't get it. I tried to find a sense of contentment in relationships. I didn't get it. I tried traveling all over the world and trying to get contentment, and I didn't get it. So I feel in some ways fortunate that none of the avenues I went down looking for peace actually worked for me. So I think the more you've kind of, you can sense this feeling of dissatisfaction, the better a meditator you will be, because you'll actually invest in it.
You list your, what did I say, how many is it? 10 benefits that you got from meditating. Quit smoking and drinking and eating animals all the time. I can walk into a space full of strangers and not feel social anxiety. I actually, honestly, wholeheartedly love my dad and mum. Most of the time I love myself, and if I'm acting self-destructively, I snap out of it pretty soon. I'm happy more than I'm sad. I don't feel so competitive around other men. I have more time. I'm brave. Even writing this book was an act of bravery that I didn't think I had in me. I still get angry. I still get the blues. I still feel jealous and sorry for myself, but I tend to be able to make sense of it now. The old dread of confusion is lifted. And when the shit is hitting the fan, I understand at a deep level that every single thing will pass. And this is the thing that I'd love to talk to you for hours and hours and hours, but this no self thing, because it is again against everything we think we know, that we were born into the world with no sense of self. And then as we go through into our childhood, into our teenage years, we develop a sense of ourself from, you know, things we do and things that people say to us and our interaction with other people. And what you were saying, well, what meditation and Buddhism says is that's not a good thing, to have this sense of self.
Well, think about it this way, Ray. Like our happiest moments as humans are the moments that resonate most with us are when we are doing something selfless, like a great moment of kind of a heroic moment where you help someone, where you give, where you kind of, when you fully like listen to another person, when you bring a child into the world, you know, when you're there with someone who's dying, all these moments where it's not about you, it's about someone else, for some reason resonates so deeply with us. And I think that's a great example of how the less you can, and I'm not saying, I think like the concept of no self isn't really practical on a day-to-day level, but if you can try to imagine it as the less you're thinking about yourself, the better your life will be. Like, so for example, like when you think about yourself a lot, you're kind of always checking yourself out in the mirror. You're going, am I getting a little bit fatter? Or you're going, oh, what did I say to that person? Was that stupid? Will they be offended? Or, you know, because this is the lexicon of our thoughts is very negative. It's very judgmental. So you find like the happiest people are those who are less involved with themselves and are more involved with service to others.
This is a sort of a big philosophical question, Conor. I don't expect you to have an answer off the top of your head. But it is all of you are saying, it's sort of against what we understand to be human. You know, the human condition.
Ray, I think it comes down to this two things. And I think this is very much like we're talking about like the evolutionary process. Now, when you consider your thoughts, they are largely fear-based. So the thought structures that we have in our brains keep us afraid to enable us to survive, to enable us to procreate.
And they were keeping us alive. They were keeping us alive back in the day when we were running away from, you know, wild beasts and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. And when it was so important for us all to like have 10 children because 8 of them would die.
Yeah, right.
And so this is kind of still the pattern of our brain. So moving from that fear-based brain to a more expansionist brain is our way of kind of going from. So I don't think it's against human nature. I think it's just the natural progression of human nature, that as the world around us becomes at a day-to-day level safer, at a kind of an existential abstract level, it feels a lot more dangerous. But at a day-to-day level, like, we're not getting chased down by tigers.
Yeah. So it's a way of silencing the lizard brain or the chimp brain or whatever they call it, you know, those things that worked well for our ancestors but probably don't work so well in the modern world.
So you can learn to silence your fear-based reptilian brain with This Is It by Conor Creighton, as heard on The Ray D'Arcy Show. Big headlines, big money, big controversy. The European Super League. I mean, not since Joss Whedon chopped up Zack Snyder's movie has a league caused so much furore. 12 European football clubs have gone rogue, apparently to boost the game's profile and to rake in the books. There's been widespread criticism. But on Today with Claire Byrne, Sean Keyes, finance correspondent with The Currency, raised his head above the parapet to support the move.
I spent the whole day yesterday actually fighting about this on WhatsApp, taking abuse.
So you're ready for this then?
Yeah, I'm battle-hardened. No, I think that the problem is that the existing system that we have, it worked quite well when there wasn't that much money in football. And when the richest clubs and the poorest clubs were pretty close together, it kind of worked fine. You know, when a team like Celtic or Nottingham Forest could go on a big run and win the Champions League or win the European Cup, then it was a suitable system. But since then, you know, things have changed. It's been a long, long time since that was the case. And like what we have now, right, these 12 monster clubs that everyone now hates, they are a direct consequence of the rules of the existing system. And they're what you get when you inject like tens of billions of TV revenue into the old tournaments. You get like a little hierarchy or a little cadre or whatever of ultra powerful clubs that totally dominate the sport. They're basically playing a different sport to everybody else. All the other clubs, the other whatever it would be, 20 or 15 in Europe, plus all the leagues, they're just extras on a drama that's being played out by the big clubs.
So if a problem existed, is the way to fix that problem to make it more exclusive?
Well, I think you have to pick your poison, essentially. I think that in the existing system, it was notionally fair. You know, Dundalk could, in theory, go on a big run and go all the way to the top and win the Champions League.
And that was the joy of it.
But it wasn't possible and it never happened. And in reality, everybody knows that the petrol states and the aristocratic clubs dominate the sport. And I think that at least the new system is honest. You know, it admits you've got 15 clubs, 12 clubs. They're playing a different sport to everybody else. Maybe it's appropriate that we draw up rules that are suitable for this world of mega clubs. And it's suitable that it's organised around competition among the ultra-rich clubs and maybe does that in a better, fairer, more competitive way.
OK, Ken, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us on this one. Why do you think this is a bad idea?
Well, Sean's solution is to my mind, it's the same thing as saying, look, we've got all these problems. I mean, everyone agrees we have problems. The problems in the leagues are really evident. They've become uncompetitive. Even supposedly successful teams are losing money. There's massive inflationary pressures from, you know, competitiveness and incompetence of clubs, augmented by having to keep up with other clubs who aren't playing by the same rules. I mean, the Abu Dhabi and Qatar-owned clubs, for instance. UEFA haven't policed it well. They've been incompetent administrators where they haven't been complacent. They've been outgunned by lawyers acting for billionaires. The system has problems. Everybody acknowledges this. But what Sean is saying is like saying, you know, look, the American dream is a lie. We know there's no real social mobility. This isn't democracy. What we've got here is oligarchy. So the solution is we need to go back to feudalism. And that just seems like not a good idea.
I think that, you know, it would be great if we could, you know, ransack the Bernabeu and actually strip them of their players and redistribute it in some kind of a international football revolution. But, like, I don't think you or anybody else think that's ever going to happen. Like, the clubs are dominant. They are a fact. And it's just we have to work around that. I mean, it's not that if you were drawing up a system from very, very scratch, maybe this wasn't what you'd want. But this is where we have ended up. There are monster clubs. So it's a case of either do we have the monster clubs continue to dominate the old-fashioned rules, or do we come up with a new system which at least creates a kind of a competitive dynamic among these monster clubs?
But this is the there is no alternative stuff. I mean, you're talking about monster clubs. Is the word meant to scare us? I mean, these clubs are paper tigers. They can only do what they're allowed to get away with. You know, I mean.
Would you concede, Ken, that there is a problem here that needs fixing? And if so, what is the solution if it's not this one?
There is a problem that needs fixing. This isn't the solution for a lot of reasons. I mean, what this does is make whatever problems we have now, this will create worse problems. This is obviously a good outcome if you happen to be the billionaire owner of one of the 12 clubs. Now, that's a small group of people, but the sport is a lot bigger than that. It's not just about these 12 clubs. There's a whole sport out there. There's a whole professional system out there that spans an entire continent. You know, there's the whole amateur game, you know, which spans the entire world. Now, what this idea does is it doesn't I don't see how it benefits football other than these 12 clubs or the 15 or, you know, because they were meant to be 15, but they couldn't persuade three of the key clubs to join, which is one of the reasons I think this is going to fail probably pretty soon. But it benefits these clubs because it's not creating anything new. It's not creating any new wealth. But what it's doing is it's grabbing a bigger share of the existing wealth. Maybe the pie is sort of
reading Sean's piece this morning, and what it does is it means when they can put a cap on the wages, which is what is the plan here, that there will be more profit to these big owners because they won't be spending 59% on the wages. They'll be spending 44% on the wages, so more cash in pockets.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, nobody wants to see Florentino Perez get richer or the Glazers. I mean, they have to be the least popular people in global football. And I'm no fan of any of those people. But salary caps, right? They're a good thing. Even if the owners are the biggest beneficiaries, that's really not true. The fans are the biggest beneficiaries. The problem in global football is vastly unequal resources among the clubs. And it's robbing it of true competition. You know, if we could abstract away the question of owners getting rich, I think we would all agree that it would be great if there was a salary cap so that all teams could compete with each other on an equal basis. And I think that you can't institute a salary cap unless you have a system like this, but for practical reasons, because, you know, in order to institute a salary cap, you know, the club, the tournament has to be so rich that you can both have a salary cap and also outbid, you know, all the other leagues that weren't invited to play. So, you know, to the extent that the salary cap is good, you need something like this to make it happen. And I think that it's that I'm focused on. It's the salary cap. It's the potential for other financial resources to flow to the least wealthy teams among the 15.
Yeah,
and it all comes together to make the 15 more competitive.
How's the money going to flow to these other teams? I mean, if you ignore the teams that are inside the wall that you're the building of this castle, what about all the peasants outside? How's the money going to flow to them?
Oh, no.
I see Florentino Perez talking. It's not going to. Is it? It's not going to trickle down to the vast sport that exists outside the walls of this tiny castle that's been built to house the self-appointed elect of clubs who have decided to be different from everybody else. How's it going to? You're not telling me it's going to trickle down to them.
The peasants are in a lot of trouble. I would agree on that.
But that's the peasants are everybody else. Why are you looking at it from the perspective of a billionaire owner? What's good for them is not necessarily what's good for the vast majority of people. No. And how do these people have the idea that they can do what they want with these clubs? This, I think, is the really key thing about this. They're the owners obviously in the legal sense. I mean, but they seem to think that this gives them the entitlement to treat these clubs as they want. But how can they really be said
to own? But maybe, Ken,
clubs?
It's time to abandon any pretense that football is about more than just money.
But it is about more than just money. That's why that's why it's got power. I mean, it's about generations of time that's been, you know, what is it that makes Manchester United worth so much money that the Glazer family wants to own it? It's generations and generations of people have built up this thing. People have an emotional, have an emotional charge because they went there with their grandfather who's dead now. When they go there, they think all of these things are activated. You know, the players that have been there over decades have built up this.
But you could have made that argument when United died.
Huge collective effort time. And now these billionaires in Florida are saying, actually, we're going to put a fence around that. We own all that. And we're going to take it and do whatever we want with it. It doesn't matter what you, the people who have created it, it doesn't matter what you want. It doesn't matter that you're against it.
This is what we're going to do. And Sean, you think that's okay?
No, I think you could have made that exact same argument when United joined the Premier League. And I think it's yes, you have to separate it. Yes, the owners benefit. The owners got richer from the Premier League too. But the way they got richer is by creating a great league that everyone wants to watch. And the real beneficiaries of the Premier League has been the viewers. It's turned into this amazing spectacle. And it's like, when the owners get rich, I mean, no one particularly is motivated by that. But like creating a great spectacle, which is where there's a level playing field, where the best teams can go at it, I think that's what people really want. And that's the benefit of this new system.
So what we want as fans, you're saying, is to see Messi versus Ronaldo every week. That we want that spectacle, and that's what this will bring us.
Well, like take like Ken here, right? Ken's a real football man, and I'm sure that Ken has missed out on like maybe 80% of the career of Lionel Messi, of like the world's the greatest player of his generation, because Messi's been off playing in a different league and Ken hasn't got time to watch every league in the world. I think that's true of all the great players. And I mean, there's a lot to be said for that. You know, we don't know what we're missing out on now because, you know, we don't actually see Mbappe or Messi, so we don't kind of miss the fact that we don't see him. But I think if we did see Mbappe or Messi week in, week out, we'd say, this is great.
Ken.
Well, I mean, I think it's just that sort of idea of it's Christmas in heaven. You know, it's Christmas every day. There's a thing called a hedonic treadmill. You know, you can feel happy and excited about something, but if it's the normal state of affairs, you just get used to it. And the result of watching Messi Ronaldo every day or every week or however often they could get to play in this thing would not be that we'd be incredibly excited. Oh my God, did you see what he just did? Did you see that? It would simply be that we'd get used to it. It would seem normal, and everybody else would look like they needed assistance to walk.
Going back to what Sean said earlier, you know, I was saying like some of the joy in this is that Dundalk could make it. They could make it to the very top. And he's saying, oh, that never happens. But that's why people play the lottery, isn't it? Because of the hope, Ken.
Well, yeah, I mean, the hope, you could say, I mean, it is this, there is the criticism that it's hypocritical. You know, this is kind of just this is just formalizing what in practice we have.
Well, that's Sean's point, isn't it?
Yeah, but there is still the difference that this is in principle. I mean, if you wanted to attack Sean's point from a different angle, if for one moment, which I don't really want to do, but for the purpose of the conversation, we'll accept, okay, say if we wanted to agree that we want to have a stable top division for Europe, which, you know, is run like the American systems and which avoids all this kind of crazy snakes and ladders element of European football where, you know, you can have Virgil van Dijk injured and you miss out in the Champions League and suddenly your entire club economy blows up, as seems to be about to happen to Liverpool, which is why their owner is so keen to avoid anything like this happening again. Say we accept that for one moment and we say, okay, we do want to have a European Super League. It wouldn't look anything like this. This is so narrow, this idea. The NFL is a 32-team league that spans the entire United States. Anywhere there's a big city, there's an NFL team somewhere in the region. There's, I think, 32 teams, 30 cities, 23 states, I think it is. This is three countries.
Ken, the NFL, didn't start like that, right? You know, the NBA and the NFL was founded in 1970. Since then, it's added six clubs. The NBA was, in 1970, it had, I think, like 12 clubs, and now it has an additional 14. Like, If this thing is a commercial success, which let's say it probably will be if it goes through, like I would agree that 12 teams is far too few. And I think that like the even Real Madrid and the insiders would agree too. That's what has happened in the States. It's been in the interests of the existing club to expand the franchise out because you can grow the pie more than you divide it up by adding an extra player. So I think that, or an extra team. So I do think that over time, that's how this could develop and it could evolve. And now, I know what your counterpoint to that would be, the additional team they bring in. I'm not sure that it would be, you know, a great football club like Valencia or Roma. It might be a franchise which they dump down in Moscow or in wherever else, Hamburg, based on wherever the local market is.
Qatar, they didn't use the word Europe in this. Yeah, but you know, again, I've made the mistake here of agreeing to hypothetically accept the premise that this is something we want, and I'm just going to go back to denying that premise because you can see the anger that this has been greeted with, and why is that? It's because people feel as though this actually belongs to us, the owners, the billionaires in America. Or in Abu Dhabi or whatever, are acting as though they own it, you know, as though it's a supermarket. It's not like that. This actually has deep emotional meaning to people, and it goes back through time, such that when the owners of Manchester United and Liverpool want to say, well, let's just cancel all the history, or we're resetting all the clocks to zero, welcome to this brave new world, people react violently against that. No, this is, you know, this isn't what
I'm not emotionally invested in this, but when this broke over the course of the last few days and we were talking about it on the show yesterday, I thought, does nobody realise that football is about money at this level? Does anyone know how much a kit costs for it? my 7-year-old son. Does anyone know how much it costs to get into one of these games? Do you not see that this is always about money? And this just formalises that. This just strips away the pretense that it's about anything else.
Well, it's not about the money. I mean, the reason it's about something else, and that the thing that
it's about
really
something
about,
else that the leads thing, these clubs to extract as much money from fans as they possibly can.
They're profiteering off the thing that it's about. The reason that your son wants to get a football shirt isn't because he wants, you know, whichever the owners of his club is, that, you know, to have an extra. I don't know how much a football shirt is. I don't buy them. they cost a lot of money. But it's about something else. And this maybe is really bringing that so sharply into focus that I think that's where a lot of the anger comes from, particularly in Britain. I think it taps into some deep currents there. You don't see Nigel Farage tweeting about football very often. The last time he did was when Millwall supporters booed their team taking the knee, and obviously he was with the supporters on that occasion. He doesn't tweet about football very much. He doesn't care about it. But when he sees a billionaire plot backed by, as he put it, globalist banks, who are these guys who are trying to steal away the working man's game, then Nigel Farage goes into his happy place. He knows. He knows that this is a theme we're chasing.
And Sean, I want to bring Sean in here because he's reacting in front of me as you're speaking here, Ken. I want to know what's on your mind, Sean.
I'm sputtering with rage. No, I think, like, in 1990, if we'd have been having this debate on the show and we'd said, OK, Sky is coming along and they want to inject billions into the sport. And I said, well, OK, things might change a bit. You know, we're probably going to have no more English players in the teams for a start. And maybe the kits are going to cost £100. And we're going to have a lot of foreigners coming to visit to watch the games all the time. A 1990 traditionalist would have said, well, like, football, the authenticity, it comes from our parents and our grandparents. That is, we cannot question that. That will not happen. It will ruin the sport. It will be a complete failure. And that's not how it's worked out, has it? I think people's fandom is more malleable than all that.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, Gary Neville yesterday, we played the clip, didn't we, on the programme. Everybody was playing it all over the place. But we paid to hear him say that. You know, we paid to see him on Sky Sports, Ken. It's the reality.
Well, I suppose so. I mean, people are paying, I suppose, to hear this conversation as well. You know, I mean, it's not unusual that, you know, magazines used to be sold. People would buy them. I mean, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with that.
Well, your point is this is just a different level, right? And this is excluding clubs which otherwise had a chance. Now they don't.
Well, it is clearly doing that. I mean, it's different qualitatively from the establishment of the Premier League because it's denying the opportunity for any other clubs to join this self-appointed aristocracy who are really just sitting there at the moment wondering, you know, trying to keep a poker face and wondering if they can get away with what they're trying to do here.
The only way to this aristocracy at the moment is to be a petrol state and to buy a club. There's no other way.
Sean Keyes of The Currency and Ken Early, co-host of the Second Captain's podcast, on Today with Claire Byrne. Sleep that knits up the ravelled sleeve of care. The death of each day's life, sore labour's bath, balm of hurt minds. Hello, Leaving Cert Shakespeare. Well, my sleeve of care is less ravelled and more ravaged. So what can be done to preserve and cultivate our solid 7? On Today with Claire Byrne, Professor Andrew Coogan, behavioural neuroscientist and director of the Chronobiology and Sleep Research Laboratory in Maynooth University, had the answers.
How real is this coronasomnia I've just mentioned?
Yeah, so what we're really talking about here is insomnia. And insomnia is a chronic sleep disorder characterised by an inability to fall asleep, to stay asleep, or to be refreshed when you wake up. Now, nearly all of us will have experienced one or all of those symptoms at some point in our life. But insomnia is a problem when it's chronic, when it's ongoing. So one of the precipitating factors that we know is really important for insomnia disorders is anxiety, is depression symptoms, and stress. So, of course, if the pandemic and everything that goes with the pandemic is raising anxiety levels, stress levels, symptoms of depression, psychological stress, then we would expect that to be reflected in rising incidences of insomnia. And of course, then insomnia feeds back. So if we're not getting enough sleep, that can feed our anxiety, that can feed our stress, that can feed our symptoms of depression.
Yes, and that brings the problem then for the next night. But on the other side of this, people may not be commuting as much, they may not be quite as tired, so there may be a reason why you're not sleeping as much, and there might be for good reason.
Well, so we did a study on this, and we showed that something that we term social jet lag is decreased. So social jet lag is basically the discrepancy between when our bodies would like us to sleep and when our social and work and school obligations force us to wake up and force our sleep schedules. So for most of us, normally, actually, when we should be sleeping is more reflected in the weekend or work-free days. That's actually when our body would prefer us to sleep. Now, most of us don't have the option of sleeping like that, and under normal circumstances, we about 80% of us use an alarm clock because our body is not yet ready to wake up on the mornings that we've got to go to work.
What's your take on naps, Andrew? Good or bad?
So naps, it's a mixed bag for naps. So naps can be really useful. The benefit you get from a nap is actually disproportionately large to the amount of time you spend in the nap. So 10 or 20 minutes nap can give you a real boost and relieve a lot of sleepiness. Where you probably might not want to be napping is if you are having problems falling asleep at night. So you probably want to have a situation where you're going to bed as sleepy as possible to maximize your chances of actually falling asleep. And a nap could relieve that and actually make you less sleepy at bedtime.
I have a question about shift work, which I'll come to in a moment. Yep. But the 20-minute nap, that's a really difficult one to do, because if you're tired enough to need a nap, you probably feel you need longer than 20 minutes, and it's very hard to rouse yourself after just 20 minutes.
So that can be a problem. It's something called sleep inertia. So that's sort of woolly-headed feeling we get, you know, when we wake up, and it can take half an hour or an hour to shake off. So it really depends. The other thing about napping is, like, for older adults, napping is a sort of natural thing. Older adults will naturally nap longer, so we wouldn't want to put out a message that napping is bad and it should be avoided.
Yeah, it can suit some people. So let me bring you this question then, from someone who works in healthcare, working different days every week, mostly 13-hour shifts, night duty every 3 to 4 weeks. Every member of staff struggles with lack of sleep or disturbed sleep. Have you any ideas to help us?
Yeah, so sleep and shift work is a big problem. Basically, in shift work, when it's a rotating shift work, so you're rotating from morning to evening to night shifts, your body clock can never catch up with that rotation of the shift. When you're on night shifts, you're trying to sleep then during the day when you come home off the night shift. And that's really difficult because, again, our bodies aren't designed. We're trying to make ourselves do something where our physiology is saying, you know, daytime is the time for us to be up and about and to be active. But because we're working the night shift, we're trying to sleep. There's no silver bullet to shift work and to sleep problems in shift work. There are some recommendations, you know, about diet and about, you know, trying to keep, if you are trying to sleep during the day, try to keep the bedroom as quiet and as dark as possible. But it's a really tricky question, and shift work, and a lot of people do shift work. About 20% of the working population actually undertake shift work. So it's a big problem out there. But unfortunately, there's no silver bullet to it.
Okay. And how about binge watching? So this is a new way of watching TV over the last 10 years or so, where you're not just watching one episode of something, you're watching three or four, sometimes more on a bad night. How does that impact sleep? Do we know?
Yeah. So, well, we don't know precisely, but we do know a couple of things. So we know that the light that's emitted from devices, so your laptop, your telly, your phone, is actually particularly enriched at blue wavelength light at the short end of the visible spectrum. And we know that that's the type of light that our sleep system is particularly sensitive to, and the time it is particularly sensitive to it is in the evening to early night. So if we're staying up all night, you know, binge-watching 12 episodes of House of Cards or whatever, actually the light that's coming off the device that we're watching it on could actually be disturbing our sleep. So when we try to go to sleep afterwards, we find it much more difficult to do that.
Okay, and that touches on sleep hygiene then, and the phone in the bedroom as well, and using the phone as an alarm clock. I'm not looking at anybody myself. it's a bad idea. We know it's a bad idea. Slightly addictive, but do you recommend that we just don't have the phone where we're sleeping?
Yeah, absolutely. So sleep hygiene basically says that we should use our bedrooms for sleep and, if we're lucky, for sex and nothing else. So phones out of the bedroom, devices out of the bedroom as dark and as quiet as possible. Now, clearly, that's if you can. Not everyone is fortunate to be in that situation. And obviously, if we're working from home and we're using our bedrooms as offices and all that, that makes it more difficult. But if you can, keep your bedroom as clean and as simple as possible. Definitely phones and devices outside.
Yeah, but you see, we've developed an anxiety now about the reliability of the old-fashioned alarm clock.
You
know, where you'd be awake half the night worried that it's not going to go off. Aisling's husband twitches and jumps in his sleep, sometimes violently, but most times low-level movement, just enough to wake Aisling up. It doesn't seem to wake him up or disturb his sleep. Is there a name for this, or more importantly, a solution?
So what you probably have there is something called a parasomnia. So parasomnia is a sleep behaviour. So they can be sleep talking, sleep walking, even grinding your teeth, moving about in bed. They happen generally in the phase of sleep that we're not dreaming in. Some people have more sleep parasomnias than others. Generally, you are more prone to have a parasomnia if your sleep is more disturbed. So if you're having problems with sleeping and you're getting insufficient sleep, you're probably at more risk then when you do get to sleep of sleep talking, sleep walking, joshing around in the bed, doing these various things.
And what can you do about that?
Well, you can think about things like sleep hygiene and try to maximise the quality of you and your bed partner's sleep. But it may just be an individual style of the individual as well. So some people are just more prone to this. Some people are more restless. You know, they sleep well, but they're more...
They move around and that just might be the way they are. Just,
exactly.
We have about 30 seconds left, but I really want to ask you about sleep trackers, Fitbits, Apple watches, because Mary says that her Fitbit says she's getting 4.5 hours of deep sleep out of 8. She's read the average is 1 to 2. Is it normal? But bigger than Mary's question, do you recommend those things?
No.
Great.
I have an activity tracker. I don't use it for sleep. Look, the way I'd express it is, well, what are you going to do about it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't just magically sleep more. And I would have big concerns about the accuracy of the data that comes off a lot of those things. Okay.
Professor Andrew Coogan, behavioural neuroscientist and director of the Chronobiology and Sleep Research Laboratory in Maynooth University, chatting to Claire Byrne. And that's it for today. Thanks for listening.